Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Christian. I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop on Current Perspectives on the Future of Cancer Research. And today's program is supported by GlaxoSmithKline and Merck & Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I just want to let you know about who you are on the call today. We have over 205 participants on the call today who come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Belgium, Canada, India, Israel, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Romania, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call, and we're delighted with your interest in this program today. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mark Criss. Dr. Criss is William and Joy Rain Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Attending Physician, Thoracic Oncology Service, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Criss will be addressing understanding the current perspectives on the future of cancer research and clinical trials, enhanced knowledge of the molecular portrait of cancer, and antibody drug conjugates, ADCs. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Criss.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you for the chance to speak today. Well, I have to say I would probably answer those questions as I'm struggling to understand because there is so much to learn. And in some ways, it's so complicated. So just to let you know that we're all in this together and we're all learning. I'd like to focus on just a few areas that I think are the biggest developments and the ones most likely to impact many, many patients over the next few years. I think the first one is the term neoadjuvant therapy or induction therapy. What I mean by that is instead of the quick removal of a site of cancer at the time of its discovery, administering generally a drug treatment prior to the surgical removal or a destruction by another means. What we have seen is that when you give medicines before surgery, number one, they're more effective. Number two, they're much easier to tolerate. They have fewer side effects. And particularly when you have a very potent medicine, you can even nowadays think about postponing or not having surgery. And there's a very dramatic example of that developed by physicians here at Sloan Kettering, where people that were set to undergo surgery of their lower part of their colon, their rectum, with the excellent benefit by medicines, they didn't have to have surgery. And now we know years later that strategy is still effective. We're seeing this trend across all kinds of cancer. I'm a lung cancer specialist, and we've been doing this for quite a long time with great success. But breast cancer, colorectal cancer, colon cancer, melanoma, all these are important. So I think to the persons on the call today, I know it's counterintuitive that you would want to do something before a surgeon could completely remove the cancer. But in 2024, it makes a lot of sense to do that, and it increases the chance of cure. Another huge development is the ability to find the DNA from a cancer cell in the bloodstream. This technology is evolving, but it's going to give us several great opportunities. Number one, after you've had a surgical removal, you then can look for the presence of DNA remaining in the blood, and you could use that as a trigger to decide whether or not you should get additional therapy. And one of the struggles we've had is we give this so-called postoperative adjuvant therapy to everybody. If we had a way of saying who really needed it, it would spare people that had their cancer already cured. Minimal residual disease is a term. The other thing that can happen is that in people with more advanced forms of cancer, after you administer a treatment, you then look for the presence or the absence of the cancerous DNA in the bloodstream, a simple blood test. And you can decide whether that therapy was effective and whether or not you need to switch to a perhaps a more intense or a more effective therapy. More and more, these blood tests are going to be performed. They're generally available in just a matter of days or a week or so, and they're really going to change the face of who we give treatment to. Another area that is a fairly big change is, I'll call it oligotherapy. People getting targeted therapies, again, treatments directed against a molecular target or immunotherapies, those that have only a small number of metastatic sites, even in the setting of metastatic cancer, removing those metastatic sites after chemotherapy can lead to long-term benefit and cure. Sometimes all the cancer shrinks but one piece, some so-called persistent disease, or only one piece of cancer grows while the rest is controlled. And by doing radiation or surgery or ablation, even in the setting of metastatic cancer, people having those procedures can live longer and be rendered cancer-free. And this is development, again, across all kinds of cancer. And the bottom line here is that each of these interventions, each of these innovations improves the chance of curing cancer. And I just want to say that we physicians are more and more focused on how we can cure cancer with immunotherapeutic drugs, combining systemic therapies with surgeries. We have that chance of cure, and we are really pushing that agenda. And even in cases of metastatic cancer, by the judicious use of treatments before, during, and after surgery, we can cure more patients. We've seen that even in the face of metastatic cancer. So the future, I believe, is very bright. These innovations I've talked about are here now. They're being implemented more and more in all types of cancer. And I think I urge you to be open to using treatments with surgery, with radiation, with ablation, to improve the chance of living and improve the chance of cure. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Chris. That was really an outstanding presentation, really our first speaker. And so thank you so much for really setting the stage for the program as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Jaramillo. And Ms. Sarah Jaramillo is an oncology social worker, and she's an Insights Program Coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be addressing healthcare disparities research and its future significance for greater access to healthcare. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Jaramillo.
Thank you so much for the introduction. Healthcare disparities are important in the research conversation because it refers to the differences in health outcomes, such as mortality rates, disease prevalence, and or life expectancy between populations, as well as differences in access to adequate healthcare services that is determined by individuals' race, age, gender, sexual orientation, geographic location, socioeconomic status, and immigration status. Marginalized groups have been historically excluded from promising healthcare research, including cancer research, that results in creating disparities in access to cancer treatments that will be effective within marginalized groups. Disparities within populations may result in higher mortality rates, issues with medication management, limited access to clinical trials or new emerging cancer treatments, financial toxicity, and limited resources. Healthcare disparities research is imperative to the field of oncology because it allows professionals to identify and address access to cancer screening, diagnoses, and treatment amongst different populations and allows identifying specific needs that they may have depending on their barriers. Healthcare disparities research also educates professionals and prompts them to analyze clinical interventions and improve and modify for specific populations, therefore improving survivorship outcomes. Healthcare disparity research also aids in reforming and creating healthcare policies and practices aiming at improving the overall quality and efficiency of cancer care. And this includes increase in diversity within clinical trials, within healthcare staff, increase in cultural humility trainings or diversity trainings, an emphasis on patient-centered care that considers social determinants of health and how they impact an individual. So addressing healthcare disparities is a matter of social justice and equity, and it highlights the ethical responsibility to ensure that all individuals, regardless their race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, or geographic location, have equal opportunity for optimal access to cancer care, including cancer prevention, treatment, and survivorship. So not only does healthcare disparities aim to understand inequities and disparities within cancer, but it also aims to improve clinical practices promoting health equity for all cancer patients and survivors, and reducing healthcare disparities in oncology also contributes to broader public health goals, such as reducing overall cancer burden, improving population health outcomes, and achieving health equity across the diverse communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Harmel. That was a superb presentation. Thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Al Benson III, and Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson will be addressing current perspectives on the future of microsatellite instability, MSI, mutations in DNA, mismatch, repair genes, and future implications for treatment. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. One of the important molecular or genomic tests on a person's tumor is testing for deficient mismatch repair or microsatellite instability, designations that refer to the same biological phenomenon but differ how they are tested in the laboratory. Deficient mismatch repair is also referred to as a tumor agnostic test, since it can be seen across many different tumor types. There are now a number of clinical trials across tumor types focusing on immunotherapy strategies for these patients, and results from recent trials have already changed the standard of care for many of these individuals. Briefly, microsatellites are short repeating DNA sequences across the human genome. These sequences are very prone to errors, and there are genes that correct these errors. If a tumor has deficient mismatch repair proteins or microsatellite instability, these errors are not corrected and tumors can develop. Mismatch repair genes can be altered through germline or inherited mutations. Pathologists now are routinely reporting mismatch repair status, especially for patients with colorectal or endometrial cancers, and it's important for individuals to know their mismatch repair status. For an example, 15% of colorectal cancer tumors are deficient mismatch repair, and most of these are sporadic or non-inherited. Most patients have earlier stage disease and do very well after surgery, but 5% of cases have advanced or metastatic disease, and these are individuals who have shown significant benefit from receiving immunotherapy. Lynch syndrome is the most common inherited syndrome where we see deficient mismatch repair tumors. In Lynch syndrome, there is a germline or inherited pathologic variant in at least one of four DNA mismatch repair genes, and these are referred to as MLH1, MSH2, and PMS2. Is what the pathologist will report whether are present or absent. The most significant risk for a Lynch syndrome patient is the development of or endometrial cancers. However, we also see risk for ovarian, renal, bladder, gastric, small intestine, pancreas, bile duct, prostate, and skin cancers. The importance of identifying individuals with deficient mismatch repair tumors is to make sure they do not have an inherited syndrome, since that affects how we evaluate an individual with specific guidelines for surveillance and screening, but also to identify family members at risk through testing and genetic counseling. Also, people with deficient mismatch repair tumors, as I mentioned, are the ones most likely to benefit from immune therapy, which has been a major oncologic advance. For example, we now have clinical trials evidence that so far there are deficient mismatch repair rectal cancer patients obtaining complete responses from immune therapy, thus avoiding chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. This remains a really important area of research, and particularly trials for people with colorectal and endometrial cancers, and we do urge people to participate in those trials. Thanks very much for your attention, Dr. Mesner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. Just a wonderful presentation and covered a lot in a very brief time, and really I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Wong. And Dr. Wong is Professor of Medical Oncology, Melanoma and Cutaneous Malignancies, Executive Director, Integration and Program Development, Cancer Network, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Wong will be addressing the future of artificial intelligence, AI-driven approaches for diagnosis and treatment of cancer and cancer treatment vaccines. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Wong.
Good afternoon. It's my honor and privilege to be with you today and to speak about these really sort of timely topics. Artificial intelligence, what is that? One definition is that it's the development of computer systems that can perform tasks that normally require repetitive human activities such as visual perception, speech recognition, translation between languages, or in simple language, the science of making machines that can think like humans. But more importantly, thinks like human doesn't mean human, and people misinterpret that. It needs information and needs processing. And artificial intelligence is actually encoded by humans. So it's unlike the popular movies, sci-fi movies that we see, there's no danger this thing will take over and do its own thing on us. It's great for repetitive tasks and pattern recognitions and associations. So we do see a role where we can recognize patterns in people and in diseases that help us sort of get to a quicker diagnosis. It can help us recognize patterns in things like radiologic appearance of things and patterns of how tumors can present themselves. So there is a place for it. It is, however, a growing area. And I remind everyone that AI requires information generated by people. So no danger in replacing people. It is a tool that doctors can use to get to a quicker diagnosis to help us really answer questions. So the important thing I tell folks is that AI can help us answer questions. It doesn't know, however, what questions to ask. That is in the realm of us. So and so it's a tool that's important and will help us hopefully do things quicker, faster. And frankly, many of us are okay with having it take over some of the repetitive tasks that we do every day. Frees us up for the more important things. The other topic I want to touch on today is a topic of vaccine. And vaccine is a type of treatment that helps the body's immune system, the stuff that we are equipped with that recognizes things that don't belong to us. So it's a treatment that helps the body's immune system recognize and destroy cancer. So two parts, recognize and destroy. And in order to recognize things, vaccines can help look for and highlight the differences between we, normal tissue in our bodies and the cancer, which has mutated to something different. And vaccines really exploit that difference. There are multiple ways of doing that. Examples include using strategies to bring the immune system to where the tumor is and causing the immune system to really force the immune system to recognize the cancer in that location. So there are these are vaccines that we inject directly into tumors to do that. That's an example. Another example is to use molecular techniques. You've heard some of my colleagues speak about molecular type approaches. Here we look at the mutations and the proteins that are unique to that cancer and try to find ways to get the body to recognize that. And vaccines can do that by introducing these unique molecules to our body so our bodies can generate an immune response against that. It is a strategy which is showing a lot of promise because it seems to show some degree of efficaciousness and a very low degree of toxicity. So that's important. I do want to point out there are currently vaccines right now today that have been in use and have shown some benefit. Examples include the hepatitis B vaccine, which prevents hepatitis B infection. And why is that important? Because infection leads to liver scarring, which leads to liver cancer. So in many Asian countries, hepatitis B vaccination is a major public health push. And concomitantly, there's been a drop in liver cancer. The use of anti-HPV vaccine has significantly reduced the incidence of cervical carcinoma in women, for example. So we do have public health measures right now today, and there is more and more and more of these vaccines coming forth as we begin to recognize the drivers of cancer and now have tools that can exploit the differences between cancer and your normal body in order to make a therapy from that. So bottom line is AI is important. No danger of it replacing people. It's helpful to us. It makes us better doctors and helps patients as well by getting to a quicker diagnosis and to recognize patterns and vaccine strategies coming right to the forefront of oncology right now. It's still early days, but the promise is there. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Wan. It was a wonderful presentation, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. Thanks so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Katie Gribben, and Dr. Gribben is BMT and Cellular Therapy Program, Weill Cornell Medicine, New York Presbyterian. And Dr. Gribben will be addressing CAR T-cell therapy, immune checkpoint inhibitors and blockade, and monoclonal antibodies. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Gribben.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for having me. So I'm happy to be here today to talk a little bit about immunotherapy, including immune checkpoint inhibitors, CAR T-cell therapy, and monoclonal antibodies. So I just want to start by saying that our body's natural defense against cancer cells is really our immune system. So our immune cells, which include B cells and T cells, among others, recognize cancer cells within our body and work to eliminate them through an evolved immune response. Cancer cells, though, have also evolved in ways to evade our immune system and to effectively survive, even in the presence of a normal immune system. So immunotherapy broadly refers to the practice of better engaging our own immune system in ways to more effectively fight against cancer cells. So in order to avoid destruction of our own healthy tissues by our immune system, cells within the body talk to one another, telling each other not to attack. This effectively puts the brakes on immune activity by T cells. Many cancer cells, in fact, survive this way by dampening the immune response of our bodies. And immune checkpoint inhibitors are antibodies that essentially release the brakes on this suppressed immune activity, allowing T cells to attack cells. This leads to an anti-cancer immune response, allowing the entire immune system to better recognize and fight against cancer cells. And immune checkpoint inhibitors are now commonly used in a wide variety of cancers, including lung cancer, colorectal cancer, melanoma, renal cell carcinoma, many other cancer subtypes. Some cancers are particularly sensitive to immune activity, and in these, checkpoint inhibition can often be used alone. In other cancers that are not quite as sensitive to T cell activity, checkpoint inhibition is used in combination with chemotherapy or with other agents. the therapy is usually given regularly for either a defined period of time or over the long term. And checkpoint inhibitors, I just want to point out, as others have said, have really changed the way that cancers are treated over the last many years. So next, CAR T, or chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy, is another method of essentially increasing T-cell immune responses against cancer cells, but works slightly differently. So rather than engaging T-cells that are already in the body, this therapy works by first removing T-cells through a process called apheresis, next genetically altering these T-cells to recognize and attack cancer cells of interest, and finally expanding these T-cells and infusing them back in for cancer treatment. So a patient who receives CAR T-cells is essentially receiving back his or her own T-cells that have a new ability to powerfully target cancer cells. CAR T-cells are manufactured and given as a infusion with close follow-up afterwards, and at this point are usually used to treat mainly hematologic malignancies, which include lymphoma, leukemia, and myeloma, but CAR T-cell therapy for many other types of malignancies, including solid tumors such as lung cancer, is currently investigated in clinical trials. And then finally, bispecific antibodies, which are a type of monoclonal antibody, are a third way of engaging against tumor cells. So a bispecific antibody has two prongs, one of which binds to T cells, and the other essentially tethering the two cells in close proximity to one another and on the T cell gauge immune activity against the cancer cell. So similarly to checkpoint inhibitors, bispecific antibodies rely on better engaging T cells within the body that have not been modified. Like checkpoint inhibitors, bispecific antibodies are typically given regularly for a defined period of time or on an ongoing basis for more long-term treatment. And right now, they are used to treat lymphoma, leukemia, myeloma, and uveal melanoma. So the side effects associated with immune checkpoint inhibitors, CAR T-cell therapy, and bispecific antibodies are all a little bit distinct, but share in common effects related to inflammation. So because the goal of these treatments is to powerfully activate the immune system, the side effects are usually related to an overactive immune system attacking non-cancer cells as well. So the first few days to weeks after therapy initiation are always the most important for monitoring of potential side effects and initiation of any treatment if needed to make sure that this balance of anti-cancer activity and inflammation remains as it should. Moving forward, you know, a major goal of cancer therapy research is to improve the effectiveness of immunotherapy in cancers that to date have been less sensitive to these therapies. And many of these emerging strategies involve combining immunotherapies with other medications in new ways to really boost the effects of these treatments that we briefly discussed. We're also continuing to research how to replace partial treatments with immunotherapies for good results and minimize side effects. So with that, thank you for your attention, and happy to take any questions at the end.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Griffin. That was a wonderful presentation. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. And Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin will be addressing the future perspectives on immunotherapy and targeted immunotherapies. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Dr. Mesner, and hello to everyone. Doctors Wong and Gribben did really a great job in laying the foundation for some of the work I would just like to mention in the world of prostate cancer, which is my level of expertise. You know, it's interesting because everybody's always wanted to use the immune system to fight cancer, the idea being that as natural as you could be, the better it is for you as opposed to having toxins put into your body. It's interesting as well to think that the very first immunotherapy that was approved happened to be a cellular vaccine, if you will, that was made from the patient's own cells and given back to them in three installments, 2 weeks apart. And yet, in spite of the fact that there were benefits to using this type of immunotherapy as it was, and the immunotherapy itself was called dendritic cells, a kind of immune cell, nevertheless, it did not seem to have any substantial anti-tumor effects. I think what people don't realize is that immunotherapy is the same as a targeted therapy. There are a variety of proteins and other molecules on the surface of a cancer cell. It's really quite crowded in there, among which many of you, I'm sure, already know, prostate-specific membrane antigen, what we call PSMA, PSA, prostate-specific antigen, molecules called B7H3, others called TROP2, even the androgen receptor, which is a marker for activation of prostate cancer cells, is a potential target. In fact, anything is a target if you are able to design essentially some sort of mechanism to get the immune system to recognize whatever is on that cell surface. As has been alluded to earlier, you know, there are vaccines. There's a variety of different treatments that are out there, including the BiTE or bispecific antibodies, antibody drug conjugates, CAR T cells. I'm just going to talk about them very, very briefly, only in the setting of prostate cancer per se. It's ironic that despite the fact that we have approval for an immune therapy, that prostate cancer, for example, is probably one of the most resistant cancers to ever succumb to immune therapy. The idea of using an antibody that is made synthetically and hooks on to a molecule on the tumor cell and then could be hooked up to almost the equivalent of a spring next to it that gives it flexibility. And that spring can be hooked up to another antibody that hooks up to the T cell, is very unique. It's a way of trying to bridge the gap, as it were, between a cancer cell and this cell that's going to kill it. And that's really what we mean by the bispecific cells. They're called bispecific T cell engagers. They're like a Tootsie Roll. They sort of have flexibility. They can be stretched a little, and they bind two cells together by virtue of a linker that will put them in proximity enough for killing. We have new data now that suggests that this is a very viable option, and at least in phase one trials have shown activity and safety. Antibody drug conjugates, again, there are antibodies against molecules such as PSA, PSMA, TROP2. All of these are molecules that are heavily expressed on cancer cells. They're not all specific for prostate, but on a lot of other tumors, including bladder cancer, even some lung cancers. They're just all over the place. But you can custom tailor an antibody to recognize it and to be hooked up to a linker molecule that facilitates the engagement with a chemotherapeutic-like drug. So essentially, you're using the antibody to bring the drug to the target. And lastly, you've all heard about CAR T cells. They're really very, very effective in a wide range of hematologic malignancies, lymphomas, and leukemias, and have really provided tremendous advantages in terms of getting people to have disease that goes into complete remissions. These chimeric antigen receptor T cells are essentially, I guess the best way to describe it is that they are able to redirect a T cell, which is the cell, immune cell that fights cancer, in such a way that you can put a particular molecule on that T cell and make it go anywhere in the body to find that molecule. Not only will it engage based on whatever's on its surface to the particular target, but it will cause an interaction that can cause the cell to die. We have so many new approaches that are now coming out for solid tumors that it's hard to keep up. Many of them are still early. Some of them are even looking better and may end up being approved. But the point is that immunotherapy is not dead. It's alive and well, and we continue to have a tremendous amount of impetus in getting more studies open and out to our patients. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Slovin. Wonderful presentation, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce, and Dr. Bruce is the Edgar M. Hospian Professor of Neurological Surgery, Vice Chairman of Academic Affairs, New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, Director Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Laboratory, Co-Director Brain Tumor Center. And Dr. Bruce will be addressing future perspectives on surgery and robotic surgery. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Bruce.
Thanks, Carolyn. It's always a pleasure to be here working with the Cancer Care Group. This is a terrific and very timely seminar. You know, there's never been a better time in our history to be doing research on cancer treatments, and the future is only getting better. I've devoted my career to the surgical treatment of brain tumors, and I've been asked to speak on the future of surgery in cancer care. Surgery is still probably the most cost-effective chance of a cure for patients with early-stage solid cancers. And when you think about the nature of surgery, the surgeon must be able to visualize the tumor that's being removed. The surgeon has to see the anatomy to prevent accidental damage to important structures such as blood vessels or nerves. And furthermore, the tumor at its interface with normal tissue must be visualized to safely get a complete removal of the tumor. Therefore, better and more precise removal of cancerous tissue has been driven by improving the surgeon's ability to actually visualize and see and distinguish between healthy and diseased tissue during surgery, and to be able to safely separate that disease from normal tissue. A major surgical advance has been the use of image-guided surgery, where an MRI or a CAT scan is done before the surgery and then is connected to computers in the operating room, so they can then project the image on the screen in real time so the surgeon can see where it is working in relation to the rest of the body or the diseased organs. This is especially important in my specialty of neurosurgery, where it's extremely important to distinguish between normal brain tissue and the tumor. Additionally, there's been a lot of work done with fluorescent-guided surgery, and this is where a fluorescent dye is injected into the patient's body. And this dye preferentially goes into the tumor, so that all of the fluorescence accumulates in the tumor. And then during surgery, you can use a special light, like a black light, and the tumor will actually glow with fluorescence. So the surgeon can visually see the glowing tumor and separate it from normal or non-glowing tissue. Now, an area where a lot of innovation is happening is in minimally invasive surgery, with the goal of minimizing the amount of damage done to normal parts of the body during the surgery. And this is where robotics comes into play. Robotic surgery allows for very precise and agile surgery in very small places, very small spaces. So it's mostly used for like gallbladder surgery and hernia repairs, appendectomy, things of that nature. And the main benefits include reducing the time in the hospital and the operating room, as well as a lower complication rate because you're causing less damage to surrounding tissue. So this is now being used more and more in cancer surgery, particularly prostate surgery. And robots can manipulate a camera in a very small space, which allows you to visualize the tumor with high-quality three-dimensional visualization, providing a great depth of perception despite using a smaller incision or opening. Overall, it actually reduced the cost of surgical care. And it's often being combined with artificial intelligence algorithms so they can be used to help guide the robots as well. And along those lines, machine learning is also used to perform certain tasks autonomically and with minimal surgeon intervention. If you want to think way into the future, it includes the possibility of telesurgery or remote surgery, where someday surgeons may be able to perform procedures on patients while they're in a different location. This could be useful for remote areas of the country or remote areas of the world or on a battlefield, or maybe someday even for space travel. So in conclusion, progress and surgery and better visualization are tied together. artificial intelligence may be helpful for both decision-making, both before and after surgery, and robotics are a reality, although its widespread use and application is still a work in progress. It remains really a great testament to human ingenuity and innovation and optimism for the future. Regardless of technology, surgeons will continue to be an important part of the multidisciplinary teams that are now needed to effectively treat cancer. And additionally, surgeons will continue to play an important role in research, including clinical trials of surgical procedures, devices, and techniques. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Bruce. That was really very interesting and a wonderful presentation. Thank you. I know there'll be questions for you also during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Sean McBride. And Dr. McBride is radiation oncologist, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. McBride will be addressing radiopharmaceutical therapy, RPT, and also radiation therapy in general. And I'm going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. McBride.
Thanks so much, Dr. Misner. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today about radiation therapy and cancer treatment. Broadly speaking, there's two major types of radiation therapy. There's external beam radiation, where a machine called a linear accelerator delivers from outside in photon radiation to target a particular tumor. External beam radiation is used predominantly in newly diagnosed localized cancers, less commonly, although increasingly so, in metastatic or chronic cancers. The biggest advance in the past few years in external beam radiation has been, like Dr. Bruce alluded to, the ability to precisely target the tumor. And this has been aided by image guidance. The use of such imaging technologies as MRI to more precisely target the tumor with high dose per treatment radiation that compared to the low dose per treatment that we administered 10 or 20 years ago is much more likely to kill the tumor. A second and very exciting development in radiation therapy is radiopharmaceuticals. Radiopharmaceuticals are typically IV medications, intravenous medications, delivered in most commonly patients with metastatic cancer. There's two types of radiopharmaceuticals. There's what are called beta emitters, which are radiopharmaceuticals that emit electrons, and they travel relatively long distances that are lower energy, and there's alpha emitters. These are radiopharmaceuticals that emit helium nuclei, which are much more powerful but travel much shorter distances. What are radiopharmaceuticals? Well, basically, they're small molecules or peptides or antibodies, the word you've heard frequently in this call, to which are attached radioactive elements that decay and release either electrons, as they do for beta emitters, or helium nuclei, as they do for alpha emitters. There's a variety of cancers that are currently treated using radiopharmaceuticals. Thyroid cancer, one of the cancers where radiopharmaceuticals were first brought to bear. Neuroendocrine cancers, where something called the somatostatin receptor is important. And I think most exciting in prostate cancer, which is the disease that Dr. Slovin and I treat most commonly. Prostate cancer has seen a rapid growth in the availability of radiopharmaceuticals over the past 3 or 4 years. One of the first and most promising radiopharmaceuticals in prostate cancer is called radium-223. This is an alpha emitter. And in a critical clinical trial in the 2010s, it was shown to improve survival in individuals with metastatic prostate cancer to the bone. And then more recently, and perhaps most exciting of all, is the FDA approval of a drug called Pluvicto, which is a beta emitter. This is a drug that a small molecule to which is bound a radioactive isotope called lutetium-177. And this drug is approved to treat metastatic prostate cancer that's no longer responding to hormone therapy, the most common treatment used in metastatic prostate cancer. And unlike radium-223, this drug can treat metastatic prostate cancer wherever it's located, whether it's the bone or lymph nodes or solid organs like the liver or the lung. Radiopharmaceuticals also have an opportunity to synergize with other types of cancer therapies. Immunotherapy and radiation treatment, there is a good deal of preliminary evidence of some synergy there, and there are ongoing trials to determine whether radiopharmaceuticals, when combined with immunotherapy, may make it more likely that the body's immune system will recognize the cancer as foreign and attack it like it would a virus or a bacterial infection. The other area where radiopharmaceuticals may synergize is with external beam radiation, the type of radiation I mentioned at the top of the conversation. Here, we're using external beam radiation to treat the tumors that you can see, and using radiopharmaceuticals to kill microscopic cancer that you can't see on imaging like MRIs, CT scans, or PET scans. And those kind of combination trials, I think, is where the field is going in the next few years to decades. Thank you very much, Stephanie.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. McBride. That was really very interesting, and thank you so much. I know the big questions to you as well during the Q&A, so thank you. Thanks. And our next speaker is Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell, and Dr. O'Donnell is Clinical Director of Early Detection and Prevention of Cancer, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. O'Donnell will be addressing increasing focus on prevention, early detection, lifestyle, exercise, nutrition, and hydration. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. O'Donnell.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here this afternoon and to be talking about a topic which is filled with so much optimism. I began my career in oncology in 2001, and I think about the tremendous progress that has been made over the past two decades, and it's absolutely at the foundation of what inspires me as an oncologist. You think about all of the drugs that have been developed. We did not have targeted therapies just two decades ago. And so I think an important question is, what does the future look like? Well, I think there are two components that are worth highlighting. One is the development of new strategies to detect cancer earlier. So there is a new science of multi-cancer early detection and single cancer detection through new techniques that employ screening one's blood for fragments of DNA that may be suggestive of cancer. So this is an evolving field and an active area of research which has the potential to open up the access to cancer screening through a more easy, potentially complementary blood-based screening, and also may increase the breadth of what we're able to screen for. So currently we only screen for cancers: breast cancer, colon cancer, cervical cancer, and lung cancer in smokers. So there is a new horizon that is under development for using your blood to be able to screen for cancer. And there are a number of clinical trials going on in this area. But beyond the novel sciences that are going on both in cancer detection and treatment, there's also investigation in complementary medicine as well. So thinking about our lifestyle and how we can really optimize our wellness in our fight against cancer. And so some of the different components that often come up are things such as exercise, nutrition, and, you know, it's really important. The research to date has all been suggestive that exercise before, during, and after cancer treatment is beneficial. To what extent you can exercise is a discussion with your doctor. So if you're currently exercising, that is wonderful, and it is really important to maintain your level of activity. It's a little bit of use it or lose it. But if you are, you know, really trying to start to feel better and to want to optimize your health, then it's good to touch base with your physician. There are actually a lot of resources that can help patients. Specifically, you can be referred to physical therapy for cancer-related fatigue and cancer deconditioning, and that's a great way to safely jumpstart engaging in activity that may be beneficial to your health and overall wellness as you go through cancer therapy. And really, there are two other components to highlight. If you can exercise, that's great, a combination of aerobic activity and physical strength conditioning, but again, that needs to be under the guidance of your physician. But there's also really just trying to stay active. So very often people will offer to do things for you, particularly around the house. And it may be necessary at times, but to the extent that you can, it's critically important to maintain your activity level and to stay busy. The small things like emptying the dishwasher, doing the laundry are actually important for keeping your mobility and strength. In addition, just doing any type of activity is always beneficial, whether it's getting out and walking or putting on some music, dancing around your house. All of these types of physical movement will only help your overall wellness. In addition to that, it's important, particularly as we are in the summer months now, to stay hydrated, to be aware of how much you're drinking, and to try to have 8 glasses of water per day. In terms of nutrition, we are also in an area of active research, things such as the gut microbiome, that is the bacteria that line our GI tract, are becoming better and better understood, and a lot of different areas within cancer are exploring both what are the microbiomes in different disease states and how can we change them to potentially better our outcomes. So there is so much exciting work going on across the spectrum in oncology, and as I said, we've seen a revolution of cancer therapies over the past 2 decades, and I think the forecast is very good in our ongoing work to not only improve the treatments that we have for cancer, but also to find cancers where they're earlier and to ultimately cure as many cancers as we possibly can. So thank you again for the kind invitation, and have a wonderful day.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. O'Donnell. That was just a wonderful presentation. And the whole concept of early detection, prevention, lifestyle, exercise, these are all such important areas for us to all focus on as well. And now, before we move into the Q&A, I'm Carolyn Messer, and I just want to say a few words about Cancer Care. Now, Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization, and we provide free programs and services. And many people who live in the United States contact our Hope Line at 800-813-4673. And in the Hope Line, the phone is answered by one of our oncology social workers. And the oncology social worker, usually the person asks a question of the person who is called, and they usually address that question. And then they usually review with them all the services that we offer. And so I'm going to just do that with all of you now as well. So the services we offer are, we offer practical, financial, and co-payment assistance, which really makes a tremendous difference for people. And we also help people with food insecurity issues. And we also have a number of online support groups, both for specific types of cancers and also for different groups of people, for caregivers, for young adults, older adults, middle-aged adults, LGBTQ adults, really for the whole spectrum of everyone who requires services from Cancer Care. In addition to that, we also have what we call a resource navigation team. And so if we don't have the resource that you need when you call us, that team will stay with you until you get the resource you need, whether it be in your cities, your community, your state, or regionally or nationally. So that's really important to know as well. We also have coping circles, which are support groups on different topics, and people find those incredibly helpful as well. We do offer also many of these programs, about 70 or 80 per year. And we do also offer a number of publications that you can access from our website, www.cancercare.org. Also, all of our programs are they occur live, like today's program, but they also are archived on our website as a podcast, and they're up for at least a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so you can access all that information, and they're organized by cancer topic and cancer type. And now we're going to move to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Krista to go ahead and explain to you how to queue up the questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Krista?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And we have a question for Dr. Griffin. Are there new treatments available for blood cancer patients who received CAR-T therapy but then relapsed?
Hi.
Yes. Yeah, so I think we're always thinking about how to use CAR T cells both for patients who relapse and also how to move CAR T cell up earlier in the line of therapy so that patients who could potentially benefit from CAR T don't need to wait until they've already had another treatment beforehand before getting them. So there are a lot of trials now in the heme malignancies looking at advancing the CAR Ts up in the line of therapy. So that being said, once that becomes more and more of a widespread practice, then yes, there's especially going to be a growing need for therapies after CAR T. Some of the promising ones that we've seen emerge recently in the last few years have included bispecific antibodies, for example, in lymphoma. That's really been a big focus. And other small molecule inhibitors that are more targeted to specific disease subtypes. But it's a great question, and I agree that when we think about eliminating chemotherapy and focusing more on immunotherapy right from the get-go, it also becomes important to think about what to do if immunotherapy is not effective for as long as we would have hoped.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. For Dr. Wong, are there discussions around forming new policies that protect patient information and privacy as AI is integrated into diagnostics and treatment?
Thank you very much. That's a great question. There are very strong rules now. We call them HIPAA rules, which protect patient information. And one of the things that's important, remember AI has to go and get the information and collate it. And there are different levels of privacy that have to go along with that. For research purposes, there's a firewall which does not allow any sort of query, whether it's electronic or AI or whatever, to access information at the individual level. You may look at population statistics or aggregate data, but almost never at sort of individual level. The tools that are being formed now are being used inside the electronic medical record system to help sort of make diagnosis at individual patients. In that particular situation, that information does not leave the EMR, the electronic medical record, but is used just as we use other calculators. For instance, we use calculators to figure out how to dose patients. We use calculators to figure out sort of kidney function and so on and so forth. Those stay inside the EMR and basically are firewalled away. So the answer is there are robust rules. The intent is to protect patient privacy, and that's really the bottom line.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And for Dr. Bruce, are all forms of robotic surgery minimally invasive? Are there disadvantages in comparison to traditional techniques?
Yeah, well, not all surgeries are minimally invasive, but in general, the trend is to be as minimally invasive as possible. Now, there are sometimes if you have a cancer that's particularly widespread where, let's say, you're trying to get the margins on the tumor, well, then you may not want to be minimally invasive. You want to have the maximum exposure possible. So minimally invasive surgery is a great technique that's mostly employed these days, but it's used selectively to get the best outcome without causing any kind of damage. But there are times where cancer surgery has to be very wide open and expansive.
Well, thank you so much. And for Ms. Jaramillo, can you discuss healthcare disparities, research, and medical mistrust? Is this a common barrier to recruiting patients, participants?
Yeah, absolutely. So it will be a topic that can take a whole day, but in short, I will say that disparities definitely plays a big role in research, and some individuals within marginalized populations have a mistrust within the medical system, so that can be an added barrier of including them in clinical trials or any new emerging treatment. So the patient communication or patient-doctor communication is really important and imperative in order to establish that trust. So then the patient can ask questions and make better decisions for their care.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. This question is... For Dr. Slovin, what kind of blood tests are available for stage 0 or stage 1 cancer, which has been treated and there is no evidence of disease, but there is still a chance of recurrence?
So I think Dr. Chris hit on it a little bit earlier. There are what we call biomarkers, and I think that's what you're alluding to, which are just either proteins or pieces of DNA that come from the cancer cells that upon the cancer cell's journey throughout the body get destroyed, they get traumatized, and pieces of membrane and even pieces of the genetic material called the DNA can be detected. Now, not every solid tumor, for example, has the ability to shed this kind of DNA very early on in the disease process. We usually expect to see either what we call circulating tumor cells or cell-free DNA or other remnants of the cancer cells when there's a very large tumor volume. We are trying desperately to look for markers in the bloodstream very early on that tells us, you know, how somebody might respond to a treatment early on in the disease. So for somebody newly diagnosed, we look upon genomic profiling of the tumor to guide us in terms of, is there anything unusual about the tumor that would make us use a particular treatment down the line if needed? But as it stands right now, it's still considered under development. We don't have established tests for the most part, but again, it is an area of high priority and is actually part of a lot of investigational trials where we are actually collecting blood specimens and looking for those particular markers to help us understand who may relapse and who may do very well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And for Dr. Benson, are there cases of mismatch repair random, or can they be predicted?
Well, they can't necessarily be predicted. So if you do know that someone has Lynch syndrome, we have very distinct screening programs so that we can detect abnormalities early. But for the majority of people who have what we call a sporadic presence of mismatch repair, meaning at least under our current base of knowledge, we don't know that they have an inherited risk, these can't be predicted. And therefore, it is essential that people have MSI testing at the time of tumor acquisition, whether it's a biopsy or surgery. So in many cases now, the pathologists are routinely doing the testing and reporting on the original pathology report so that we know right up front if a patient has an MSI tumor or what we call a microsatellite stable tumor, and the majority of people will have microsatellite stable tumor.
Excellent. Thank you so much. A question for Dr. Wong. What role do toll-like receptor TLR antagonists play in cancer vaccines?
Okay. Great. Thank you for the question. And toll-like receptors are basically part of the immune system. It is a trigger for immunomodulation and to generate immune responses. It is one of the pathways to stimulate your body's immune system. For example, the current approved immunotherapies, the popular ones such as Keytruda or Optivo, which you see, in fact, on television, on ads during football games, for example, that's how popular they are. It worked by releasing, taking the foot off the brake, and allowing the immune system to ramp forward. Another way to stimulate the immune system is by pushing on the gas, direct stimulation. And that's a TLR9 agonist is an example of that, where you're pushing on the gas pedal of the immune system. Today, there's still an area of active investigations. There are multiple ways to do this. They're all the way from things that are given intravenously to topical creams to injection to tumors. I would say stay tuned to this channel. There's a lot of stuff going on in this arena, and it is going to be interesting how these things evolve. And in all the things I told you, whether it's giving intravenously, intratumoral, subcutaneously, or as a topical cream, I think there are specific applications that will be relevant to how they're given, and more importantly, how you give it may influence the end result. So stay tuned, please. Good question.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks. This is a really great question, I have to say. Thank you. And I have a question, last question is for Dr. McBride. What is the best way for a patient to contact a facility that could help their cancer treatment? Is there a central place to contact, or just contact closest large hospital near them, or do you want to comment on the National Comprehensive Cancer Centers as a location to contact as well? Dr. McBride?
I think that's a great question. I mean, in general, the government designates National Comprehensive Cancer Centers. I think those are the types of locations, the types of hospitals, the types of centers that have the greatest expertise, usually as a result of just the volume of folks they see with cancer. And I think research has shown that time and time again, the more patients you see with a particular type of cancer, the more adept the team is at treating that cancer. So my general recommendation would be to look for your nearest comprehensive cancer center, your NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center, and reach out to them. Most of the time, their websites are going to have the necessary information to guide you for your particular type of cancer. I also think increasingly, telehealth is being used for the offering of second opinions. And as long as the physician with whom you're speaking is either doing this in consultation with your local doctor or herself has a license in your state, she can provide a telehealth consultation for you and reassure you that what your local doctors or local team is recommending is what they would do at their comprehensive cancer center.
Oh, thank you so much. I want to thank our speakers. It's been a phenomenal call. We've never really had a program of this scope, really, and the enthusiasm of our speakers and the enthusiasm of our questions as well, wonderful questions that people have asked. And I know that we have many more questions that we would love to take, but time doesn't really permit that. And so I'm going to ask our speakers just to give a quick takeaway from today's program. So I'm going to start with Ms. Charmello, if you would like to comment on just a takeaway you'd like people to take from today's program.
Sure, absolutely. Looking into healthcare disparities and including people in clinical trials or any type of research opportunities is imperative in finding treatments that will be successful for every type of population, no matter their race, gender, ethnicity, or socioeconomic status. And it also improves population health outcomes, which is something that as healthcare professionals, we are all looking forward to. So thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much. That was wonderful. And Dr. Benson?
Yes, I would say what's critically important is to know your family history. That can provide valuable information for your healthcare team about risk. Also, if you have a diagnosis of cancer, make sure you speak with your team that the appropriate molecular determinants on your tumor have been performed, including, if appropriate, a deficient mismatch repair status. And also to talk about, is there an available clinical trial that's appropriate for your specific situation?
Thank you so much. And Dr. Wong.
Thank you very much for inviting me and for this opportunity. I want to leave you with a thought that clinical trials are important. It is a way that we can get to you, the cancer patient, the latest technology that we have. We just can't open up the cupboards and use it. We just have to use it in a systematic way. I want to point you in the direction of the informed consent form. Why? Because it is a form that tells you in hopefully plain English what people are doing, why they're doing it, and gives you insight into the technology that's involved. If there's anything that you should walk away with today is that the field of cancer is exploding. It is no longer a death sentence to have the diagnosis of cancer. In fact, if anything, us as oncologists, we now have the routine expectation of response, and we now know that we can cure a good number of our patients who walk through the doors of our clinic. Good luck.
Wow, thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Wong. It's wonderful. And Dr. Griffin.
I'll just say, you know, to echo what everyone else has said, I think the future is really bright with the available therapies that we have, and things are moving quickly, more and more every year. And I'll also make another plug to look into clinical trials and also to really find doctors who you trust, and don't be afraid to speak up more than one opinion, especially at the beginning or when you're making a big decision.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Slovin.
Well, we are finding more and more novel molecules on the surface of tumor cells that will serve as targets for a variety of different treatment platforms. And the exciting part about it is every meeting that we go to in oncology, we discover another molecule that is proverbially targetable. And that is means that we can deliver drug and we can deliver more immune approaches and really make use of areas within the tumor microenvironment that have never been targeted before. So I echo everyone's enthusiasm about the great future that we have looking toward.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Bruce.
Yeah, let me just say surgery is still an important part of managing cancer therapy, and the surgical techniques have never been better. And the techniques are not only safer, but providing better long-term results. And so it's still very much part of the future for cancer treatment.
Well, thank you so much. And Dr. McBride.
I think this call really reinforces the importance of having a good multidisciplinary team as part of your cancer care, and having an expert surgeon, a medical oncologist, radiation oncologist, social work, nursing team. That's one of the most critical aspects of quality care.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, this has been an amazing call. I just want to thank all of our speakers again and our participants. And although we didn't have a chance to take everyone's question, we nevertheless, we hope that you'll go back to your treating healthcare team with the information you've learned today and that you will actually take that information back to your treating healthcare team and so that you can use the information you've learned on today's program with your healthcare team. Again, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.